All right, ready to dive into Marsh v. Alabama?
Always.
Looks like we've got excerpts from the case itself, a legal brief, and some notes geared towards law students.
Sounds like someone's about to get a crash course in First Amendment rights. And talk about a case study. I mean, a town where even just walking on the sidewalk could get you in legal hot water.
Yeah, not exactly the image that comes to mind when we think free speech, right? So let's set the scene. Where does all this go down?
Chickasaw, Alabama. Back in the 1940s, picture this. A town that looks and functions like any other. Streets, houses, shops, a post office, you name it. They even had a business district.
Sounds pretty normal so far.
Except for one tiny detail, the entire town, owned by the Gulf Shipbuilding Corporation, every last inch.
Ah, company town.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where our protagonist, Grace Marsh, enters the picture.
Grace Marsh.
She's a Jehovah's Witness, and like many in her faith, she's on a mission to distribute religious literature.
Okay.
So she arrives in Chickasaw, steps onto what seems like a perfectly normal sidewalk, and starts handing out pamphlets.
Seems harmless enough.
Yeah.
What could possibly go wrong?
Well, remember, this is a company town, and that means every inch of Chickasaw, even those sidewalks, is private property.
So the company wasn't exactly thrilled about Grace spreading her message on their turf.
Not exactly.
Wait a minute. Hold on. She was on a sidewalk, right? Not inside a building or someone's home. It's not like she was barging into private residences.
You would think so, but this case, believe it or not, goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And the question becomes, does the First Amendment, does it even protect you in a privately owned town that's essentially open to the public?
So you got this classic showdown brewing.
Yeah.
Private property rights versus free speech. Who wins?
In a 5-3 decision, the court sided with Grace Marsh.
They did.
Yep. Justice Black, writing for the majority, argued that despite being privately owned, Chickasaw essentially functioned as a public space.
Interesting.
Their reasoning. If you're going to create a town that looks and acts like a public space, you've got to accept the responsibilities that come with that.
Responsibilities like upholding constitutional rights.
Exactly, including freedom of speech.
So no having your cake and eating it too. You can't enjoy the benefits of a town setting while denying the freedoms that we typically associate with a public space.
Nope. Justice Black actually has this really great line that sums it up perfectly. He said, "Ownership does not always mean absolute dominion."
Whoa, that's a powerful statement.
It is. It really underscores the limits of private power, even when we're talking about property rights.
So did the court offer any kind of specific justification for this, or were they just going with their gut feeling?
Well, this is where the public function doctrine comes into play.
Public function.
The court basically argued it's not just about who owns the property, but how it's used. They looked at Chickasaw and saw streets and sidewalks and shops, things that were open to the public and things that served a vital function for the community. So even though the company owned the land, the town itself was operating as a public space.
So even though the company technically owned the land, they had created a de facto public space.
You got it. And that meant the company couldn't just shut down free speech just because it didn't align with their views.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm guessing this decision didn't sit well with everyone, though, right? I mean, what about the dissent?
Oh, you're right. There were some strong dissenting opinions in this case. Justice Reed, for example, he worried about the slippery slope this whole thing might create.
What did it mean?
Well, he basically said, if a company town can't restrict speech, what's to stop protesters from taking over shopping malls? Or what's to stop activists from setting up camp in privately owned parks? He saw this as a trespasser's victory, you know, something that could really undermine the whole foundation of property rights.
Okay, so he was coming at it from a very different perspective, one that prioritizes property rights above all else.
Yeah, it seems that way. He believed that property owners had an inherent right to exclude unwanted activities from their premises, even if those activities involved the expression of ideas. For him, this was like a fundamental principle of ownership, something the majority decision totally disregarded.
So it sounds like he was less concerned with Grace Marsh and her pamphlets and more concerned with this ruling being used as a weapon against property owners in future cases.
That's a good way to put it. It's a reminder that legal decisions don't exist in a vacuum. They have ripple effects that can impact countless other situations, and it's crucial to think critically about those consequences.
Absolutely. So where do we go from here? We've talked about company towns, but I'm guessing this case has implications that reach far beyond Chickasaw, Alabama. This whole public versus private space debate has become even more complex these days.
Absolutely. I mean, think about the rise of shopping malls. They've practically become town squares in many suburban communities.
Which brings us to the Pruneyard case, right? The one about students gathering signatures at a mall.
You got it. 1980, Pruneyard Shopping Center v. Robbins goes to the Supreme Court. And guess what?
Right.
They invoked Marsh v. Alabama as a precedent.
Oh, really? Did the mall owners use Marsh to argue that they could restrict speech on their property, just like the company in Chickasaw?
They did. But both the California Supreme Court and eventually the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed.
So even though both cases dealt with private property that had taken on a public function, the courts drew a distinction.
Yeah. The California court argued that because the mall was a place where people naturally gathered and the students' activities didn't disrupt business, their free speech rights outweighed the mall owner's property rights.
Sounds like the concept of public function from Marsh was stretched even further in Pruneyard.
You could say that. Courts recognize that malls, even though they're private, they've become these modern-day public squares, especially in the suburbs where traditional public forums might be limited.
It's amazing how the law adapts to these changing social landscapes. From company towns to shopping malls, and now I'm guessing the internet is next.
You read my mind. The internet, and particularly social media platforms, they're like the ultimate challenge to this question of private ownership versus public function. These platforms have become essential spaces for communication, for debate, even for political organizing.
Which begs the question, do these platforms, places like Facebook or Twitter, do they have the right to censor content, ban users, control what people are saying? I mean, they're private companies, right?
It's the million-dollar question. And it's one that courts and lawmakers are dealing with right now. And you know what?
What?
The debate often circles right back to Marsh v. Alabama and that core tension between private ownership and public function.
It's kind of mind-blowing to think that a case about a woman handing out pamphlets in a company town back in the 1940s could still be so relevant in today's digital age.
I know. It's a testament to how foundational this case really is. Marsh v. Alabama wasn't just about a woman and her pamphlets. It was about the limits of private power in a democracy and how we define public in a world that's increasingly privatized.
Makes you wonder where the line will be drawn next.
Doesn't it?
We've covered a lot of ground here, tracing the impact of Marsh v. Alabama from company towns to malls to the wild world of the internet. And I think it's safe to say we've only just begun to scratch the surface.
We have. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, I think it's worth taking a closer look at some of the concurring and dissenting opinions in this case. They offer some really valuable insights into the legal reasoning and some potential concerns surrounding this landmark decision.
That sounds like a great place to pick up next time.
But
before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the preferred position doctrine. I think our listeners, especially those gearing up for law school or just interested in legal debates, would really benefit from a deeper understanding of that concept.
Agreed. Let's dig a little deeper into Justice Frankfurter's concurrence. He was known for, well, let's just say he took constitutional interpretation pretty seriously. And while he agreed with the outcome in Marsh, he wasn't 100% on board with how the majority got there.
Right. You mentioned he wasn't totally sold on using the Commerce Clause as the main justification. What was his issue with that?
Well, the Commerce Clause, it basically gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among the states, right?
Right.
So the majority in Marsh, they used this to argue that since Chickasaw functioned as a town, it was engaging in interstate commerce and therefore fell under federal regulations, including the ones protecting free speech.
I see. So by tying it back to interstate commerce, they could bring federal law into the equation.
Exactly.
But what was Frankfurter's problem with that logic?
He felt like it was kind of a stretch. Legally speaking, that is. He argued that this case should have been decided solely on First Amendment grounds, focusing on, you know, that fundamental right to free speech, without getting bogged down in commerce regulations.
So he thought the majority was taking this roundabout way to reach a conclusion that could have been reached more directly.
Yeah, like using a sledgehammer when a scalpel would do.
Great analogy.
Frankfurter believed the First Amendment on its own provided all the justification they needed to protect Grace Marsh's right to distribute literature, regardless of whether or not Chickasaw was technically engaged in interstate commerce.
It's interesting how, even when the justices agree on the outcome, there can be these little disagreements about the best way to apply legal principles.
it really shows that the law isn't always black and white.
Definitely not. A lot of nuance involved.
Absolutely. And those differing opinions within the court, they often hint at future legal debates that are going to come up.
Okay, so we've talked about Frankfurter's concurrence. Now, what about Justice Reed's dissent? He wasn't just quibbling over legal technicalities, right? It seemed like he was genuinely opposed to the whole outcome of this case.
You're right. He had a totally different perspective. He seemed to put property rights above pretty much everything else.
Exactly. I mean, he was really worried about the implications of this decision.
He thought it was setting a dangerous precedent, one that could weaken property rights under the guise of protecting free speech. His dissent is a really powerful argument for that viewpoint.
It is. I mean, he really painted a pretty bleak picture of what this ruling could lead to. Didn't he even use the word trespassers?
He did. He argued that if a company town can't even control what happens on its own property, even in areas that seem public, like sidewalks, then what's stopping protesters from taking over shopping malls or, you know, political activists from setting up camp in private parks? He saw this as a slippery slope, one that could end up undermining the whole concept of private property.
So he was basically saying that the court was handing a victory to trespassers, people who would exploit this ruling to infringe on the rights of property owners.
Yeah, that's a good summary of his position. He really believed that property owners have this inherent right to exclude activities they don't want on their property, even if those activities involve expressing ideas. For Justice Reed, that was a fundamental principle of owning property. And he thought the majority totally ignored it.
It's almost like he was less worried about Grace Marsh and more about the potential for this ruling to be used against other property owners down the line.
Yeah, that's a good point. He wasn't necessarily saying she should have been arrested, but he was saying that the court's decision created this dangerous legal framework that could be used to infringe on property rights in the future.
Right. And that's a good reminder that these legal decisions, they don't exist in isolation. They have these ripple effects, and it's important to think about what those might be.
Couldn't agree more. And that brings us to the idea of the preferred position doctrine.
Preferred position.
This doctrine basically says that certain fundamental rights, like the right to free speech, they're given more weight when they come up against other rights, like property rights.
Okay, so in this case, the court was basically saying that even though the company had property rights, free speech was more important, right?
Exactly. It was a key takeaway from the case. But it's really just the start of a much bigger conversation.
Well, speaking of bigger conversations, we've talked about company towns, but this case has implications far beyond Chickasaw, Alabama. This whole debate about public versus private, it's even more complicated now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about shopping malls. They basically became town squares for a lot of suburban communities.
Which is where the Pruneyard case comes in, right?
Yeah.
The one with the students gathering signatures at a mall.
That's the one. 1980, Pruneyard Shopping Center v. Robbins goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And get this.
This should be good.
They actually used Marsh v. Alabama as a precedent.
Wow, really? So the mall owners, they tried to use Marsh to argue that they could restrict speech, just like that company in Chickasaw.
They did. But both the California Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court, they disagreed.
So even though both cases were about privately owned spaces that had become kind of public, the court saw a difference.
Yeah, they did. The California court argued that since the mall was a place where people naturally got together and the students weren't interfering with business, their right to free speech was more important than the mall owner's property rights.
Sounds like they took the public function idea from Marsh and expanded it even further.
I think that's fair to say. The courts recognize that malls, even though they're privately owned, have become these modern-day public squares, especially in places where there aren't many traditional public forums.
It's fascinating how the law has to adapt to these changes in society.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
From company towns to shopping malls, and you know what's next, right?
Oh, I think I do. The internet.
Bingo. The internet, and social media specifically, they present the ultimate challenge to this whole idea of private versus public. I mean, these platforms have become essential for how we communicate, how we debate, even how we organize politically.
So that brings up a huge question. Do these platforms like Facebook and Twitter, do they have the right to censor content or ban users or control what people are saying? Because at the end of the day, they are private companies.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it's something that courts and lawmakers are wrestling with right now.
Makes sense.
And the debate often goes right back to Marsh v. Alabama and that central tension between private ownership and public function.
It's incredible that a case from the 1940s, about pamphlets in a company town could still be so relevant to our digital lives today.
It really is. Marsh v. Alabama, it wasn't just about the pamphlets. It was about the limits of private power and how we define public in a world where more and more things are privately owned.
Wow, makes you wonder what's next. What's the next frontier in this whole debate?
I know, right?
Well, we've covered a lot, from company towns to malls to the vast world of the internet. And it feels like we're just getting started.
We are. But before we jump ahead too far, I think we should take a closer look at the concurring and dissenting opinions. They offer some really valuable perspectives on the legal thinking behind this landmark case.
Okay, that sounds like a good place to pick up next time. But before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, the preferred position doctrine. I think our listeners, especially those who are interested in law, would really appreciate a deeper understanding of that.
Definitely. It's an important concept.
Okay, so let's unpack this preferred position doctrine. It sounds like it's a pretty big deal when it comes to how courts weigh different rights against each other.
It definitely is. Basically, it recognizes that some rights, like freedom of speech, are just more fundamental in our legal system. They get a preferred position, so to speak. So when these rights clash with other rights, like property rights, courts are more likely to side with the preferred right.
So it's not an automatic win, but it's like having a secret weapon that can tip the scales in your favor.
That's a pretty good way to put it. It really highlights how crucial certain rights are in a democracy. It's like the court is saying that freedom of speech is so essential to how our government works that it needs extra protection, even when it comes up against other important rights, like owning property.
That makes sense. But how do they decide which rights get this preferred status? Is there like a list or something, or is it more of a judgment call?
Well, it's not as clear-cut as having a set list. Figuring out which rights get this preferred position has evolved over time, you know, through legal precedents and scholarly debates. But generally, things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, those are usually considered the most protected. But the exact boundaries of this doctrine, those are still up for debate.
So it's not this rigid concept. It can change as society changes and as legal challenges come up. Like in Marsh v. Alabama, the court basically said that even though the company owned the property, free speech was more important in that specific situation.
Exactly. They recognized that the town, even though it was privately owned, it had become a public space in a way, a place where people would naturally expect to exercise their First Amendment rights. So in that case, free speech won out over the property owner's right to restrict it.
It's amazing how something like property ownership, which seems pretty straightforward, can get so complicated when you throw these fundamental rights into the mix.
Right. It really shows how intricate our legal system is.
It does. So for everyone listening, why should we care about this case? I mean, it happened almost 80 years ago.
That's a great question. I think Marsh v. Alabama is still important today because it reminds us that our rights don't just vanish when we step onto private property, especially when it's open to the public. Whether we're in a shopping mall, an airport, or even just surfing the internet, the ideas in this case still influence where free speech ends and private ownership begins.
It's easy to forget how important those freedoms are, you know, especially when we're in spaces that feel public. But this case shows that those freedoms aren't always guaranteed, especially when you have private companies with a lot of control.
Absolutely. And the rise of the internet, it just makes the questions raised by Marsh v. Alabama even more relevant. Think about social media platforms. They're like the new public squares, but they're run by private companies. And that creates a whole new set of challenges when it comes to free speech, censorship, and the right to gather in online spaces.
So Marsh v. Alabama, it's not just a historical footnote. It's something that's still shaping how we think about our rights in the digital age.
Exactly. It's about more than just one woman and her pamphlets. It's about a really important principle. Even in a world dominated by private companies and private spaces, our rights as citizens still matter, particularly in places that function as public forums.
Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up our deep dive into Marsh v. Alabama. It's a case that keeps on giving, raising questions that are even more pressing today than they were back in the 1940s.
Definitely food for thought.
So next time you're at the mall, scrolling through social media, or even just walking down the street, remember Grace Marsh and the case that challenged how we think about public spaces and private power? Because the fight for our rights, it's far from over.
Couldn't have said it better myself.